Hey there, I am your host, Mandy Trapp, and you are listening to the Waking Up Human podcast, a podcast dedicated to exploring the complexities of the human experience. From the biggest questions of existence to the smallest moments of daily life, it's here that we will dive into the depths of what it means to be alive and to be conscious. Join us as we explore the many facets of being human, from the science of the mind and the body to the art of living a meaningful life. And so whether you consider yourself a philosopher, a scientist, or just a curious person looking for some deeper understanding, I know you'll find something here to enjoy in this podcast. So sit back, relax, and let's wake up together. Geyha Gantier has explored various healing modalities for over 40 years, beginning with a degree in movement therapy from the College of Performing Arts in Vienna, Austria. In 1980, she studied shiatsu and oriental diagnosis with Wataru Owashi in New York, which also marked the beginning of a very deep love affair with Eastern philosophy, mysticism, and medicine. In the following years, Geyha went on to study medical massage at the Swedish Institute in New York, craniosacral therapy with David Little, nutrition, aromatherapy, and several more bodywork modalities. Miss Geyha was definitely steeped in the healing arts, but there was a deeper calling that eventually pulled her away from New York and dropped her off in a small town by the name of Antelope, Oregon. And it is here that our conversation begins with Geyha's behind-the-scenes account of what life was like living with the infamous Indian guru Osho, before, during, and after his highly dramatic charges in deportation. Not long after that, she found herself on the Hawaiian island of Maui, where she now goes on to share her experiences of living in a commune for the next decade, which was also where she was introduced to another spiritual leader by the name of John de Ruyter, who would eventually be the impetus for another relocation, this time to Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. And when I recently heard of several new charges of sexual abuse against John, I knew that there was likely no one better to speak to the topic than Geyha. Her wisdom, compassion, and insight shed some new light on the tender topic of fallen leaders and how we can be better followers in trusting ourselves as we forge ahead on our personal and on our spiritual journeys. Enjoy this conversation. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the Waking Up Human podcast. I am, as always, your host, Mandy Trapp, and I'm really deeply honored, is actually the word that's coming to mind for me today, to have this conversation with a beautiful, beautiful soul, a light on this planet, Dr. Geyha Gantier. I was practicing her last name, and I still feel like I probably slaughtered that. But Geyha lives here in Edmonton with me. We met, I'm not even sure, but probably sometime over the last 10 years. Many of you already listened to her bio, obviously coming in, but she is the founder, and I'll say the mama bear, of an incredible healing place here in the city called Wellness on White. She is a acupuncturist, traditional Chinese medicine. She teaches Qigong, thank you, Qigong. And she's also going to let you in on some of the other incredible things that she's up to. And you're going to want to stay tuned and listen to the entirety of this podcast, because the main reason that I brought Geyha in today really had to do with some breaking news that happened here in our city a few weeks ago. And it all was surrounding a spiritual teacher by the name of John de Ruyter. And if you're in Edmonton, maybe you've heard of him before. And he was somebody that I was introduced to, I don't know, I think I'd have to go back, but sometimes between maybe 10 to 12 years ago. And it was an interesting introduction. I don't really need to share all of my story on all of that. But for me, I just knew I went to the first, they call them meetings. I went to the first meeting and there was something in me that just said, this isn't for me. This isn't for me. And I was a bit confused and conflicted in that, because to be honest, I had a lot of people who I really was close to and admired. And one of them was my girlfriend who brought me, who is from New York, and she would come regularly into the city just to take part in his meetings and in his weekend workshops and things. And so I kind of felt like, is there something wrong with me? Like, why am I not feeling this sense of alignment? right? And then fast forward, you know, how many ever years it's been. And I think the bigger news and the sadder news, which is was the precipice for me to reach out to you, Geha, was that he has now been charged with, I can't remember, I'm going to look it up and I'll put it in the show notes, but I think it was 4 counts of sexual abuse, which is obviously creating likely a bit of confusion within the community. I think it creates anger. I think it creates questions. I think when these types of things happen within our families and within our tight-knit communities, is that it can really pull on a lot of things within ourselves. And one of those bigger pulls, which I really wanted to speak to today, when you feel that you've been maybe blindsided by somebody that you've trusted, is to completely turn your back, not only on that person, but on anything and everything that you've ever learned. And I know for you, Geha, just in our pre-discussion here, is there were some really beautiful things that you learned from John. And I know that you have also had the opportunity to learn some incredible things from other very prominent teachers on this planet who have also, you know, maybe misstepped or been put under fire. And there's been some controversy around as well. And yet here you are, in my opinion, as one of the most open and loving and karmically responsible and forthright persons that I know. And I would just love for you to speak. Eventually, we'll speak to that, but before getting there on how you feel about what's happening with John DeReuter and that whole community, maybe take us back to the beginning of your path and then how you landed here and how you arrived in the booming, cold, freezing tundra of Edmonton in this lovely community and within the DeReuter community as well.
Gosh, wow, what an invitation, Mandy, to start from scratch, because the beginning, where is the beginning? I mean, the real beginning was when I was a child, and the first time I left home, I was 2.5 years old, and I left home to be with God. I walked out the front door, I walked to church, and I was going to be with God. So, because I didn't feel understood by my family. Yeah. You know, now looking back, It boggles my mind that I did that when I was 2.5 years old. But I do remember so many of these aspects, and I remember the feeling, and I remember certain times very, very specifically of that day and the thoughts that brought me there. But looking back, I can see that looking for deeper answers, looking for answers that were beyond the status quo, that was already attractive to me from day one.
Yeah. Wow. So 2.5 years old.
Yeah. You know, so then again, I left when I was 7, and obviously always somebody found me somewhere and brought me back home.
Yeah.
But eventually, you know, after university, I moved to New York. And when I was living in New York, somebody introduced me to Osho. And my first response was, no way. No way. This whole Indian guru thing, that was completely weird. And then at that moment, I was an actor and a performer, and I had just been hired to play the lead in The Little Prince for
And no way.
And as we were going on tour, I spent the weekend at a friend's house making tapes for the tour. Those were still the days of where you had records and tapes, and you put together your own tapes. So, and this friend of mine had a huge record collection. So I went there to make some tapes for myself. And as I entered the apartment and had to go to the bathroom really bad, there was a book there, and it was an Osho book about Tantra. And I read right there on the toilet seat. I read that book from beginning to end in one go. I did not get off the toilet until I read that book.
Was your friend banging down the door? Are you okay?
he was gone for the weekend. So I had the apartment to myself. But anyway, it was, you know, and that's when I realized, wow, I am not alone. There are other people, there are other beings, human beings that have very similar perspectives. And that's when I became curious. So shortly after that, I took sannyas. I became a disciple of Osho. I lived on the ranch for 2 years.
Where the documentary was shot?
Yeah.
Get out.
Yes.
Okay. How was that? Can I just pause for a moment? Because I know there's a lot of people who have seen it.
Yes.
How was that for you?
For me?
Yeah.
Best experience in my life. For me, it inspired me to see that there were people that could be with one another, live with one another with so much love, so much dedication, so much enthusiasm, so much idealism. Mm-hmm. It completely matched with me.
Absolutely.
What I had trouble with was the government, the top-up kind of a thingy. I was like, I didn't quite get all of that.
Were you aware of everything that was going on?
None of it.
Really? And do you think that that was probably true for the majority of the people who were there, that they didn't know what was happening?
Yes. I think once... You know, once there were things like the bombs in Portland, and we brought in the homeless people, and mm-hmm. and things started coming up to the surface, and there were all these interviews on television, and I think a lot of people, including myself, we were a little bit like, this is kind of weird, you know? And then suddenly the Uzis came. There was a military aspect. And I think that rattled a lot of people.
Yeah.
Before that, it was all about meditation. And it was just so gorgeous. And I had never been in such a supportive work environment. I mean, I've never worked like that before. And I'm not shy of working.
Mm-hmm.
But that was over the top. But we also were building a city, and we did a great job. But there was also a place of, I felt from my perspective, provocation that was, I felt unnecessary, you know, even at that time. Now I would see it even more extreme. But at that time, for me, the loveliness of the people that I was with, the joy, the fun, the literally idealism of making something different, of I always loved that, a commune to provoke God. That
and I love
made
that.
A lot of sense to me.
So you in know? Your heart, where do you feel the breakdown began? Do you think it was from Osho? Do you think, I know Sheila
I think it was
got-
from Osho.
Yeah.
I think it was from Osho. I think it was from Osho. And maybe this sounds weird to say that, but I feel he started to believe his own hype.
It doesn't feel weird. There's a lot of, I mean, if you know the right people who really research this stuff very intricately, and I'm grateful that I do know somebody who's been very in and around these types of worlds and worked very closely with David Hawkins back in the day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Hawkins' power versus force scale is that he really speaks to what happens when our consciousness begins to rise, and there comes a point, there is a breaking point where we are challenged. And even in some religions, I was speaking to a guy who I know who went through the priesthood in the Catholic system. And I don't remember, and I wish that I could remember what they actually call that moment right there, but he said he literally felt paralyzed, like dragging himself across the floor, feeling this power of temptation, which we also know the Buddha speaks about as well, right? Yes. Sitting by the river and being visited by all of the temptations. And it is such a slippery slope that I think for all of us as human beings, in some way, shape, or form, we face that over the course of our lives. And then, of course, we get to see these with people outside of ourselves, not just spiritual leaders, but we see this with celebrities. We see this with politicians. We see this
with scientists
everywhere, right? With scientists. Yeah. And so the intention may have started very holy and very sacred. And that's what drew you in. And did you start just even intrinsically within you starting to feel that, you know, Osho was changing and shifting, or was it purely on? Yeah.
No, I definitely felt that. And then his book came out. I don't recall what it was called, but something like Memories About His Childhood. Okay. And everybody, of course, was reading it. And I was like, wow, you know, that reminds me of getting stoned and, you know, just writing. And then, of course, we realized that he was indeed always taking laughing gas.
Oh, interesting.
Right? He had a direct connection. And I'm like, oh, I guess now he's just stoned. And is that really, you know, create a challenge within himself? Can he be as clear? Can he be really as connected to his spirit? I mean, I don't know, you know, because I'm not necessarily at this level, but from my perspective, I'm like, oh, he sounds a little bit like a stonehead.
Yeah. It feels off. And so
yes,
when you left, Rajneesh, what was it called?
Rajneeshpuram.
Yeah. Rajneeshpuram.
Yeah.
Did you leave when everything was being dismantled at the end, or had you left before that?
No, I left when everything was being dismantled, because honestly, after Osho left, there were a lot of us that actually wanted to stay. I was one of them. Mm. My partner at that time, he did not. He wanted to leave. He was done with it. I wanted to stay because I loved the land. I loved what we were doing. I was hoping that we as a community could just continue with the community and regulate it ourselves, but that wasn't possible. Right. Literally everybody had to leave. And so we did.
Right. Do you feel that you guys were pushed out, or was it more of a fact that, no, it was more of a fact that maybe now that's the great revelation, that people were there purely for Osho, not that they weren't receiving all of the benefits from community, but I think it really goes to kind of, again, what we're talking about here today, is people really foregoing, like, what am I really creating here? What for myself, listening and aligning to self, versus just, no, this is me completely deflecting all of my thoughts, feelings, beliefs to somebody else. And now that somebody else is gone, I don't know who I am. I don't know how I can fit into this community and how I can go forward from here.
Right. And you know, and it was also so challenging at that time, because there was a lot of conflict around Osho. For myself, I can only admit to my own inner conflict, because I had never experienced that kind of bliss and joy that I experienced at times when Osho would dance with me. I'd never. It was like my every single cell of my body was alive with joy and bliss. Boom. I had not, and not since then have I experienced that in meditation or in sexuality or anything like that. It is just this being washed and being one. Unbelievable, you know, and there's a place where I also recognize, wow, this is, or at least assumed, this is my true nature. And if this is my true nature, then what am I putting in my way so that I'm not connected with that more on a day-to-day level, right?
Oh. And so were you able to maintain the gratitude and the connection to that, despite, I don't know, maybe I don't want to put words in your mouth, but despite any of the other, I'll just say, conflicting feelings that you had about what was happening?
You know, I stayed in touch with that. And over the years, obviously I've had more than 30 years to process this, you know.
That's a long time.
Yeah. And I realize now that that feeling was intrinsically mine. He was able to tap on that. But yes, I can come back to that over and over and over again. And I am forever grateful to him that he also kind of shook me out of my, at that time, comfort zone. Because I had to grow in ways where I didn't grow before. I mean, maybe there were other, you know, in Buddhism, they say there's so many, any situation can be a situation of growth. I get that, you know?
Yeah.
That happened to be mine. And I'm incredibly grateful for that, because there's a quietude, there's an assurance, there is a bliss, and all of that is very much what I feel I am internally. And so when I met John, if we want to continue to that, because you know, after that.
But yeah. So where did you go? Let's maybe just create a bridge here. So where did you go? So Rajneesh.
So we moved to Carmel.
Okay.
First we went quickly to New York to make some money, because neither of us had any money.
Of course. You've been living communally. You didn't really need it.
Communally, whatever, because I had made a donation at the very beginning when I came. I guess everybody assumed that I had lots of money. So I was being asked for money all the time. And by the time we were left, I had not a penny to my name anymore, you know. So we went to New York, made some money, and then came back to Oregon, bought a car, and traveled down the coast and started a business in Carmel. Lived in Carmel. My marriage, unfortunately, did not last. After 3 years, it was very clear that we had to go different ways, which was, that was probably the biggest heartbreak in my life at that time, mm-hmm. because I was really assuming that no matter what the challenges, we would just go deeper and more intimate, you know, particularly with the background that we had from Osho, but that was not the case. And then I went to Big Sur after we split up. I lived in Big Sur in a little cabin, kind of fulfilling my own ancient dream of Zen monk, living in a cabin without toilet, with only cold water, in the middle of nowhere, up on top of Partington Ridge. And that was 3 very beautiful, but also quite challenging years. But again, I learned something very beautiful, and it was truly, it was very deep, you know, being so confronted simply with yourself and with nature.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely.
And then from there, at one point, I took a trip to Hawaii and met up with some friends who happened to have bought some land on Maui. Mm-hmm. And they had a little commune there. And they invited me to come and live with them. And I said, okay. So,
why wouldn't you? You'd be, I don't know. I imagine the person who's like, no, thank you. I do not want to live communally with people who are loving and joyful in Hawaii. So you did.
So I did. And you know, that was my second communal experience. And honestly, you know, I've always had this little bit of a fantasy about communal living. Yeah. It's a lot harder than you think it is. It's a lot harder.
So, yes. so give it to us here now. I joke with my friends all the time, like, okay, here's where we're starting the commune. And now, you know, in the last 2 years, my husband and I have bought this beautiful property in the Okanagan. And it's funny, our friends come and they're like, okay, this is where the commune's going to go. You know, I'll put my house here. And secretly inside of myself, I'm like, no, you're not allowed to be here anymore. So for those who want to start a commune, what do you feel was your biggest challenge?
Structure. Structure. A kind of structure. And this is something that, and from that, actually, I learned a lot from that, because in my business now, you know, we are trying to create a structure that is what's called an everyone culture, meaning everyone's word is just as important as the owner. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't necessarily make the last decisions, the last word, that I don't have the last word, because I have to, right? Yes. It's my money that is on the line.
I was going
to
say, right? You have way more skin in the game than everybody else does.
I have more skin in the game, right? Because everybody else can go if they don't like it tomorrow. I'm out of here, right? I can't. Yeah. I mean, I could, but I can't really. So, to co-create a structure, to be committed to co-creating a structure, and that's not easy, because you know, sometimes you, obviously you want to make it right for everybody, but you can't necessarily make it right for everybody. But we can, you can make structures where you go, okay, we can live with that right now. This is ideal. This is great. This is great. With this, we can live for now until we revisit it in 6 months or in 9 months, right? And what's important in all of that is that there needs to be a commitment for self-awareness, because otherwise you can't do it. And there needs to be a commitment to taking responsibility, because once you are part of that culture and you co-create that culture, you can't point the finger and say, you did this and you're the bad one.
Absolutely. I mean, to me, listening to you, I'm like, it doesn't sound any different than my house with my husband and our children. And we try to give them as much voice as they possibly can have. And I mean, now they're a lot older too, but at the end of the day, I'm going to veto a decision that I just don't think fits for the whole. Right.
Yes.
But I can see that being a huge challenge. I can definitely see that. Right. Yes. And so how long were you living in Hawaii at that commune?
10 years.
Wow. That's a long commitment.
And, you know, it was so beautiful. It's a beautiful piece of land. It was right by the ocean. We had some neighbors, but the neighbors behind us was basically jungle.
Yeah.
You know, we grew a lot of our own food. There was a lot of trading going on. People would come to me for sessions and would give me food, would give me lungis in exchange, would give me clothes, a big bread. You know, it was a very simple, very wholesome life with lots of amazing swimming in the ocean.
I'm sure.
You know.
And so I do not understand why you came to Edmonton from Maui, as I'm sure a lot of other people, when they find out, what? Where were you living for so long? Why did you come here? Did you just wake up one day and say, man, I need a change? What was that for you?
No, we had heard, somebody had told us about John de Ruyter. Somebody had invited us to come and see him. And he came to Hana, to the library. And mm-hmm. Hana was about, I don't know, 30 minutes away from where we lived. Because mm-hmm. We lived literally in the boonies, off the grid, right? So we went to that library. And I was like, I can see that what he says is has some value to it. But I came from Osho, who was incredibly articulate. And those were the first days of John beginning to teach. Mm. You know, so he was by no means as articulate and as focused as he comes across now.
Right.
You know, no question about that. Right. Yeah, he was in the beginning. It was the beginning of his journey as a teacher, you know?
Okay. Yeah.
But then some of us decided to go to a retreat here in Edmonton. Mm-hmm. And we went back and forth. Then John came to visit us and stayed with us in Maui for a while. And we did some adventures together, and we swam with the dolphins together, and we went to the big island together. And I got to know him and I got to know his family a little bit more. You know, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I realized that there was some real value there with some of the things that he was talking about on a personality level. I don't know. I've always had this little bit of an interesting relationship with him, where I could see his power.
Yeah,
I really could see his power. But sometimes I was like, I don't think he's clean with it.
Yeah.
That's
what I felt, if I'm completely honest, in the 3.5 hours that I sat in that meeting. That's exactly intuitively what I had felt. But again, I was like, maybe I'm misinterpreting this.
And that's exactly what I'm not.
But right. Yeah. And maybe you felt the same way, right? Maybe I'm misinterpreting this. Maybe I need to give him a chance.
Exactly. Right. And so many of my friends were there.
Yes.
And, you know, so for 3 years, I would go back and forth between Maui and Edmonton. And with all of that, it became clear that also the land in Edmonton, where we were living, things were shifting in Maui, where things were shifting, things were changing. And I felt like, I don't know if this is actually my place anymore. And then one day, I said to my subconscious, and, you know, and after the first time I had come back from Edmonton, and I was so grateful to be back on Maui. And I was sitting there, ocean underneath me, up on top of the cliffs. There was this big full moon, and I was singing my songs and said, I am so grateful to be here. Edmonton, what a place. And there was this little voice and said, you're going to go there and live there. And I'm going, no. Not me. I'm not going to do this. Anyway, fast forward 3 years, and I'm going, okay, so I've been going back and forth now. What does my being really want me to do? Mm-hmm. And as I do sometimes in situations like this, I ask my subconscious for a dream that I understand. Mm-hmm. And I got the dream, and the dream was very clear. I needed to go to Edmonton. And I knew better from all my previous experiences in my life that I had to follow. Mm-hmm. You know, absolutely. I had to follow. I had to just go, okay, I don't know what this is about, but here we come. Edmonton, here we come. Canada, Edmonton, here we come.
And how long ago was that?
That was in 2003. So that was exactly 20 years ago.
Yeah. So that was...
And in 2004 was when I received my landed status.
Okay. Beautiful.
And and then I had to go back to school because some of my schooling was not recognized here anymore. Also because some of it was from so many years ago, you know, before computers, before any of these things. So they were like, yeah, whatever. I don't even know what you are, who you are, where you got this, you know? So I had to go back to school.
Yeah.
And I did. And and then I started my acupuncture practice. First, I practiced out of a doctor's office downtown, and then I opened Wellness on White.
Yeah, you did.
You've
done a beautiful job at building your own community. But when you got here, that would feel to me, I don't know the timeline on it, but that would feel to me, like you said, the earlier days of John.
Yes.
Teaching and running meetings. Was there already an established community in Edmonton that you came into?
Yes.
You did.
Yes. I mean, it was much smaller.
Yeah.
You know, it started to grow.
Yeah.
And by the time I actually went to school, by 2007, I remember coming back, and I don't remember if it was the summer 2007. I think it was 2006. I think it was the summer 2006. After the summer break, I came back to the meeting, and there was like this big, huge elephant in the room. Mm-hmm. And nobody really talked about it.
Yeah.
And I honestly also didn't feel right to talk about it, because the few people that sat in the chair and tried to address it were just met with silence. Right.
Yeah.
And again, one of the things that I understand what was John's purpose always is to follow the smallest little voice inside of him. Mm-hmm. Now, I can appreciate that. I really can. But I also feel that there needs to be discernment sometimes with that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. You know? And so what you are speaking about with reference to the elephant, are we talking about the girls?
Well, at that time, he had left his two previous wives and married somebody else.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and the two women that he was with previously, those two sisters, they didn't even know that he left. He just left.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that either at that time when I came to the meeting, but I was just so surprised because it was packed.
Well, it was packed, and it was in the newspaper.
Oh, yeah.
Right? It was in the Edmonton Journal about this. And again, I don't want to go into the details because I don't want to misquote exactly what that was. But like, let's keep in mind, this was whatever it was, 15 years ago, 16 years ago. And at that time, they were trying to press charges, which is why it was in the newspaper, around a lot of indiscretions and things like that. Mm. And I actually knew one of the girls and had had some conversations with her after the fact around that. And so she had a very interesting, you know, obviously take on her side of the story on that. But the part that didn't sit right for me was back to what you had said, this little voice. And sometimes I think it's important for us to get really clear on who is that little voice inside of our head. So you hearing the voice, you need to move to Edmonton, right? This is where you need to be, or it's time to go on. My belief is that that voice is often the voice of the heart. It's the one that's like, I can't really make sense out of this, but there's love and there's adventure wrapped up in that. But there is also the other voice, which I think for both you and I always kind of felt that little kind of hair on John about the, like, what are you being informed by? I mean, very simply, we can say that it's the ego, but it's the part that starts to become very hungry, right? For, I think, something that does not benefit others, does not benefit the whole. Maybe it's a short-term benefit for him, but it doesn't benefit the whole. And so the fact that this was in the newspapers and it was the elephant in the room and things were there, there was likely people who bowed out and maybe didn't say anything, or maybe there were some more public conversations within the community, but it was kind of like that first big red flag, you know, that I remember watching from a distance, the first big red flag going,
Yeah, well, there were a few red flags before, but just like with Osho, sometimes, you know, there are red flags when there's somebody who really goes against the status quo. Right. And yes, I do want to give him the benefit of a doubt. And, you know, also, Mandy, within all of that, and I do not want to create any kind of excuses for anybody. I do not want to create excuses for John, or I do not want to create excuses for Osho. One of the things that for both men comes as such a huge disappointment for me is mm-hmm. that I guess I expected more.
Yeah. Let's just call it like it is, Gayhi, can we?
Yes. Yes. I expected somebody of that caliber. You know, if of that caliber, when they engage sexually with anybody,
yeah,
that they are able to hold a space so juicy, so soft, so tender, so mm-hmm. inviting, that this Shakti energy is being mm-hmm. expressed in the most amazing way in that woman.
Yes.
So there would not be anything that could even scratch on sexual abuse or anything like that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is where I think this is such a huge misunderstanding. Mm. And as it comes up with Osho, the same thing. He had people come, you know, and service him, so to speak. And I don't know what John's relationship was with the women that he was with. I know there were women in the community that were hoping that he would be with them, and he wasn't. So, you know, there isn't just like one narrow path.
I agree. I think there's multifaceted responsibility in all of this. And we see this everywhere in this industry right now. And industry, I mean, the industry of spirituality and personal growth, where we can become as human beings so disconnected from our own spirit that we think that our only way back to connection is through somebody. And I guess it's religion as well, right? It's my connection is through this person. So we're willing to throw our values out the window, our own, I don't know, maybe just even our ability to be able to, I can't even put it into words. Like it feels so big because I see this all the time. And, you know, I shared this recently in a podcast that I had done with somebody else, where I so love and appreciate the fact that we had the Me Too movement that began to give voices to those who have been feeling manipulated and overpowered and controlled and forced into very, very harsh circumstances and environments. But it's not that black and white. And I think that's the point that you're getting at. I think that there, of course, and I'm not denying at all, I think that there are very black and white circumstances and situations.
Yes.
But I also know that as we walk this path, there's personal responsibility in everything. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know the circumstances of John. And so I'm not going to comment specifically on that. All that I know is that by the time police typically press charges, there's been a lot of work that's been done around that. Mm-hmm. But I think, and I will just speak very generally, specifically to women right now, because I feel like for women, we have a really difficult time finding our voice and being in our power. And a lot of us grew up feeling that the only way to power is through the masculine, it's through the male.
And that was going to be my next point. I feel what is right now, what is most important is to ask the questions, what can we learn from that? Because this conflict, shall we say, between the masculine and the feminine, this is something that we see all over the world, mm-hmm. not just in as far as men and women is concerned. Also, how are we dealing with our environment? If you were to see the earth as something feminine and us as the actors on here, you know, mm-hmm. we have been like me, we do conquer. Yes.
And absolutely.
This whole, and I'm sure you're familiar with the story of the wings of humanity, you know, and how the left wing of humanity, the feminine wing, is now getting to be developed.
Yeah.
You know, and I think the most tragic thing is not just what men think that they can do and what they feel entitled to and privileged to because, well, it's always been like that, or because they follow a voice, or because, and maybe their intentions are entirely awesome. Maybe they're really that clueless that they don't know what the results could possibly be, you know? But if I'm a man, and if the result of me being with a young girl is that she starts cutting herself, then mm-hmm. I'm going to have to, I better question myself. And if I don't question myself, well, absolutely. Then I've really messed up as a man and as a teacher and as a fellow human being. But what is, right? Yeah.
Yes. Especially, I want to just quickly say, especially as a teacher or as somebody who is in a leadership position, because I feel that we can self-proclaim that we're leaders, but really you're not a leader if you don't have anybody to follow you. Right. And so we have to be responsible followers. And to me, what a responsible follower is that I am also holding to task my leader. And I'm constantly questioning them. You know, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? I'm not just immediately throwing them up onto a pedestal and saying, you're perfect. And now I'm going to do whatever it is that I need to do. And that's not just for male leaders. That's also for females, because this isn't an issue that is only, I mean, we're using Osho and John as the examples here, but there are women leaders all over the place as well, who can sometimes, you know, be swayed maybe down a bit of a darker path, and they can become highly manipulative, right? Mm-hmm. Where men become extremely controlling is that women can become very manipulative.
Yes.
And so I think we need to ask these questions.
Yeah, we all have a dark side.
Absolutely.
It is our light grows out of our dark side. Mm-hmm. Everything that is now love and forgiveness within me has also waded through ickiness and grossness and things that I'm not necessarily proud of, mm-hmm. that I had to really learn the hard way. So I feel forgiveness is very, very, very important. First of all, ourselves. But what is also kind of to pick up what we had left off before and also continuing and what it is that you are saying is that this divine feminine. And when I say divine feminine, I'm not just talking about male and female, but that this aspect is still so insecure that we do not feel we are entitled to step up and step in and say, actually, this doesn't work for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, but no thank you.
And that's something that you and I were speaking about before we even started recording this podcast today, was because I was curious to know from your perspective, you know, what has really driven you all along, right? Have you been blindly following, right? Or being blindly led, or have you just really been able to trust? And I have to say that I deeply appreciate that within you, because I don't believe that it's the norm. I think we blindly follow a lot of things on this planet for several reasons. One is it's just so conditioned into us to not ask any questions, right? And then now in today's day and age, and I mean over the last couple of years, is that it's actually very dangerous to question, and you're not supposed to, or you'll be silenced for questioning.
Yes. Right? Yes. Which again is that same principle.
Yes.
Is that one principle that says, here's how it is, and the other principle says, really? Yes. So it's, you know, in this case, obviously, we are not calling it Shiva Shakti or divine feminine or divine masculine, but it is that same dynamic. And yeah. I feel, because this is, you know, sometimes when, at least in Chinese medicine and everywhere, when the pendulum swings to the extreme on one end, it has to swing back to the other, right?
Yes.
And as we know, in 2012 was the end of a cycle, of a huge, huge cycle. We are at the beginning of a new cycle. I feel that very strongly. And I feel part of that beginning is also that, you know how birth is really messy?
Sure do. I've done it a few times.
Right? You've done it a few times. And you don't always know what is going to emerge and how painful it is going to be. And we are certainly going through this birthing process right now. And all of these things that are bubbling up to the surface that could potentially really help us being a guideline to embrace our own power. You know, Carolyn Miss says it so beautifully when she talks about how each one of our chakras are our power centers, our energy centers through which we get to express our power in the various different ways. And when we talk about Osho and when we talk about John, both of them still, even with all the power that they did have, they were stuck somewhere seemingly in the second chakra. And what Gurdjieff was always talked about is that jump from the second to the third chakra, that da-da-da, that half note is one of the hardest notes to get to. And the only way to get to that is because you have to connect so deeply to your heart that you can literally pull that energy into your heart, and through that, you can express your personal power. And the longer I've been on the planet, the more sense that makes to me.
Absolutely. I have never, ever heard it that way, but it makes so much sense, especially if being stuck in the sacral, which is really all about that divine femininity and that womb space. And what I saw when you said that, Geha, is where these, and I'm just going to say men, but I mean, this can be for anybody, right? When they're not feeling their own personal power bubbling up, moving from there, it's where can I get it from? Who else can I take that from? And there's so much, there is so much abuse that happens in that space.
Right. And it's such a pity that it is such an abuse because, I mean, honestly, Mandy, you know, I don't know what it was like for you, and I don't know what your first sexual experiences were like, but when I was a teenager, when I first started getting really turned on a regular basis without having any idea what all of this was about, I would have loved to be held by somebody in a safe space and taught about my bliss.
Yes.
To me, that seems like a much better ritual than pornography, honestly. Right?
And I so appreciate, like, I don't know if you're on top of it, but there's so many conversations being had right now on the planet. I actually just saw a study the other day, and they were doing a brain scan of somebody, you know, before watching pornography, while they're watching it, and then after, and to see really the disintegration of the brain while it was witnessing the pornography, but then even after. Right? Is that it actually causes toxicity. I'm going to use the word brain damage to your brain. And not only is it causing that, because it's activating a lot of these different conflicting states and combative places within our brain, which fires us into fight and flight and all of those, like, let's go out and let's conquer and let's do this. It takes us away from the compassion centers in the brain, but it begins to wire all of these neural networks that begins to teach us that this is the way of connection. Right. This is the way of power. This is the way of intimacy or of survival, of procreation. And we now see, now that children have access younger and younger and younger to these things, sadly, they're beginning to think that this is normal. Right?
Sadly. Sadly. Very sadly. Yes, very sadly. And that's why I'm saying, you know, where I even said before, I wouldn't even necessarily object to a teacher being intimate with his students, man or woman, because our sexuality, if we really understand it, I mean, we are so not understanding our sexuality. We're so not understanding our
bliss.
And that's
the problem, right? That's the problem.
That is really a big key in it. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. We don't understand that it is associated first and foremost with the heart. It is an expression of the heart, you know, sort of. Mm-hmm. And so when we diminish that expression through the ritual of porn, mm-hmm. which is a very kind of, it's kind of a mental jerk off. It's not even really physical.
No.
Then I'm saying that without having much experience of watching porn, so I'm taking that because, you know, from what I've heard of people. So
yes, please,
and my imagination, just, you know. So somebody may say, "Oh no, it's really awesome and it's really gorgeous and it's really," and I'm going, "Oh yeah, okay, maybe."
Okay, but prove me wrong.
But you know, in all Eastern medicine tradition and philosophy traditions, the heart is always the center of everything. And our sexuality is, like we say, into me see mm-hmm. of that heart space. And that magnetizes a whole bunch of beauty and a whole bunch of bliss. Mm-hmm. Now, can we, I don't want to say use our sexuality, but can we live our sexuality in such a way that that actually happens? Do we have that kind of maturity? Is that what we want? I mean, personally, this is what I would love to give the next generation, because I think, you know, everything that is magnetized with the heart can process electrically with the brain. So this electromagnetic being that we are, moving through this world, attracting situations, attracting thoughts, attracting realities, creating realities, co-creating realities, can be absolutely joyful and wonderful.
Well, and I think it's the, I don't think, I know, and there's a reason why, you know, in the Yoga Sutras that Patanjali talks about brahmacharya, which is, and it's funny, we talk about this in my meditation trainings all the time, because we go through the sutras and we have a very open dialogue about which each one of these sutras means. So for people who don't know what sutras are, it's funny, outside looking in, they almost look like the Ten Commandments. But it's got nothing to do with the thou shalt or shalt not. It's really, these are very these are the common ties that really govern our human lives, right? Mm-hmm. And but not just our human lives, but it's the expression of spirit through our humanity. And one of those ties that we have is the tie of sexual creation and co-creation. But really, it speaks about sexual energy. And so the Sanskrit word brahmacharya, depending on the translation, but a lot of people say, well, no, that translates to sexual control. And I say, well, what do you think that means? And from, I will say, a very 3D perspective is a lot of people think, well, that either means abstinence or it means, you know, only consensual sexual conduct. It means monogamous sexual conduct. And it's very interesting dialogue to have, because then we can open up and say, everything that you are just speaking to, why do you think that Patanjali put this in here? Why do you think that he wanted to address so deeply this energy? And it's because that energy is so powerful that it has the power to create life on this planet, an entirely new being. And for something to be that powerful to create, it must be equal to your pendulum theory. It must be equal in power to destroy. And we see this everywhere. And I'm so with you, Geha, especially having children who are, you know, in their teens and 20 now, and being able to have these very open dialogues with them around, this isn't just about, oh, you know, make sure you love the person that you're with and that you're respectful and intimate. It's to understand, and I've said this to my daughter, the power of actually engaging in that deep and intimate of a connection is that you now carry those threads and that energetic imprint of that person with you, no matter where you go. You are creating something together. You are destroying something together. We have to be as conscious as we can be. And I think that intuitively we know how powerful this is. And if we're not in our heart, is that all of the other backtrack of thoughts and things that are going on that can feel insecure or unsafe or needing more power, needing more attention to be seen, feeling like I need to belong to someone or to something, is there's kind of that little niggle inside of us. It's like, I know that I hold the most important power to do that. And so I'm going to put myself out there, right? Or I'm going to go in and try to take that from somebody else to achieve this. And so in order for us to actually educate on this is that we have to bring people back to themselves, which is what I do in my own way. And it's what you do in your own way, to experience that frequency of energy inside of themselves. And I think this is ultimately it's the foundation for Tantra.
That is exactly the foundation. Right? Well, one of the foundations for Tantra, because Tantra is really all about being intensely present with what is.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And yes, Tantra is also very much about teaching us through all these various different systems and practices of the bliss and the joy that we are inside always. Yes. You know, in Tibetan medicine, we say that at the moment of conception, there is a spark of bliss that happens, right? Which is incidentally very interesting, because they see now they can see with certain instruments that at the moment of conception in the womb, there is a flash of light.
Yes. Right.
So this flash of bliss, they didn't have these sophisticated instruments, but yet they saw this, right? And our journey of life is to make that spark of bliss become our guiding light, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And sexuality, I feel, can very much be a tool for that. Now, for some reason, in nearly all cultures, it has been suppressed for years on end, for centuries.
Yes.
You know, and it really doesn't matter where you go, even though each culture, and it doesn't matter if it's the Arabic culture, if it's the Chinese, if it's the Indian, if it's the Christian, every single one also has a subculture of sexual exploration.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So is it time now for us to begin to understand that better? It seems to be, because particularly with that Me Too movement, it's a conversation that's in everyone's face.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I think it's time for us to explore all of the different shades of our sexuality and of love and of intimacy and of all of those things, because I don't know about you, but I've had a lot of like incredible male friends in my life, and some of them who we just had to part ways because we would love each other so much, but they didn't really understand, well, how can I show and express my love for you? Because you're not my mother. And so I'm not going to show it as you, and you're not my wife or my girlfriend. And so I must have to lean in and show you in this way, which I'm like, no, that's little, we're not going there, but it's extremely confusing for people. But I think it's confusing because, to your point, is that in a lot of our cultures is that we don't develop the language for that.
Right.
Right. Or the way to do that. Now, at this point, you know, I still have a few very, very close guy friends that it's funny. I'll have a bunch of people over and I'm like completely snuggling and cuddling up and my legs are wrapped around, you know, let's say one of my good friends, and my husband's there, loves him too. We're all having just a conversation, and people who don't know us that well are like, you know, what's your up? Husband's okay with you doing this with him right now. But what I have to say is that it requires a certain level of consciousness. And you were talking about this earlier from both parties, because just because I hold that and I trust myself from not crossing a line, I can't always trust that somebody else's consciousness is going to be there to do that. Right. So that's how that it's confusing, but I think that's what we are moving towards.
I agree. Yeah. I agree. And I think you're also a little bit into astrology, aren't you?
A little bit. Not a little bit.
Yeah. So you might also, you probably also know that right now, you know, these last 2 years were all about, particularly with Saturn still being in Capricorn and Pluto in Capricorn, it was all about restriction and top-down structure and this is, and black and white and right and wrong. And all of this is moving, so much is moving right now into Aquarius. And so this next year is still going to be a lot of back and forth as Pluto's moving in and out of Aquarius back and forth. But in the end, we will see there is going to be a whole new chapter for humanity that is beginning to open. And, you know, my commitment in all of this is to really take all of these experiences that I've had in my life and be completely committed to love and to loving and to compassion and forgiveness and just see what comes from that.
Yes.
What occurs from that? Because right now I also feel that there's so much people wanting to point the finger and this is wrong. And yes, it is. There has been a lot of poop that has been thrown around the entire globe in the last 2 years from all different perspectives. No question about that. But like, I think it was Jung that said that. I'm not sure. It is easier to light a candle than to muck about in the dark. Don't know exactly, but somebody quite famous.
I don't know, but I'm going to write that down because I feel for me that that was the stance that I chose to take over the last few years. And don't get me wrong, I'm grateful that there's people out there who are asking the questions. Right? They're the ones who are questioning the government, questioning their leaders, questioning themselves even. We need that. But I knew that things like you were changing and shifting. And I'm like, so as we dismantle everything that needs to be dismantled, there's going to come a point in time where, you know, the battle is over, the main battle is over. And if somebody wasn't busy, you know, planting the garden and building the new homes and the new structures and the new communities for people to step into, we're going to be even more lost than we were before. And then we run the risk of just picking up the pieces and rebuilding it the same way that we had always done.
Which is what we've done numerous times.
Many times.
Many times.
Many times, but I think we're doing it differently now. I think
that's I agree with you, and I'm so grateful that you say that, Mandy. Yeah. I totally 1000% agree with you.
Yeah. I feel it, and I think where I find the evidence in that is when I see what my children are doing. I see how they interact with each other, with their friends, and their communities. And I'm not saying that my kids make a lot of mistakes, as we do as adults as well.
Yes.
But both my husband and I have always parented very openly, where we don't hide anything from them. And we really, like I said, we will snuggle our other friends around them, and they'll see me kitten pile with six of my girlfriends. And, you know, my husband constantly with his guy friends are hugging and I love you. And they haven't ever really had the chance to be like, is this a bit weird? You know, are guys allowed to hug guys, or is my mom allowed to snuggle that guy? They've never had the chance to even question if that's weird or odd, because what we just endeavor to show them all the time is love and acceptance and forgiveness. Mm. And I don't only see that in them. I see that in a lot of other people who, like you and I, or even in our communities or our clients, they're also doing the same thing.
Yes.
And they have people who are watching them.
Yes.
And I know that this next generation that's coming up right now, who's in their teens and in their early 20s, they are the ones who are asking the questions.
Yes.
A lot of them
are asking amazing questions, and they're asking amazing questions of the heart.
Amazing questions of the heart. And so that's the one thing that I keep encouraging all of the kids. I'm like, keep asking questions. Even if I don't want to answer your question, and if I feel uncomfortable, don't stop asking me, because I need to feel uncomfortable.
Yes.
I need to begin, you know, my mom, who's, you know, lovely, and we have a great relationship, but I grew up asking her questions, and she'd say, like, because I said so, was always her response. Well, why is this, mom? Because I said so. And I promised to never say that to my kids. And a lot of times it's really funny, you know, when they would challenge me as little kids and they're like, why? Like, you know what? I actually don't know why. I don't have an answer to give you right now, which then beautifully forces me to go back and to question why I'm doing something.
Yes.
Right. So we need to ask these questions. We need to hold accountable, not only ourselves, but I think those, you know, just kind of circling back, who we look up to, those who we listen to, those who we follow, is to not be afraid, but to ask those questions. Mm-hmm. You know, I say that all the time to people in my community. I'm like, don't be scared of me. Don't think, oh, great, you know, Mandy's here, the teacher's here. Ask me the questions. Don't be afraid to disappoint me. If I ask you something and, you know, you're feeling like it's a no, you don't have to say yes to me. Right. But we need this door kind of swings both ways, I think. And I think just kind of even, Gay, as we come into kind of the full circle wrap up on all of this, there's something that I heard you say a few times, and it was about forgiveness.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I know how important that's been for me, but I go back looking over your life and some of the big chances that you've taken, you know, to move from overseas to North America, to move into this community and to have it, you know, completely dismantled and exposed in the way that it was. And you are following your heart to be there, to then, you know, I don't know how you want to call it, but to break from the love of your life, to coming to Edmonton, to following this community, to following your heart here, to following this teacher, and kind of the way that all of that is shaking out. And yet you keep saying forgiveness, forgiveness, forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And so,
and also something that you said, curiosity.
Mm.
Curiosity. You know, yeah. There was a long period in my life, probably about close to 10 years, where I really felt the victim. And I really, I dove into that. I wanted to get, and believe me, I proved that I was a victim everywhere, because that was so what I was identified with. To see how I was standing in my own way and not loving myself by taking that stance. Like you said before, doesn't mean that there aren't places where it's literally black and white. And yes, there are victims, but it is one thing to be a victim, and it's another thing to milk that and stay rooted to that particular archetype. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes it just goes, okay, yep, I was fucked with, and I was fucked with also because, if I'm really honest, I did not listen to myself. I did not trust myself.
Do you not feel that that's what it always boils down to at the very end of the day? Mm-hmm. Right? To me, that's the Ho'oponopono practice.
Yes.
Is that what I am seeing, you know, within this perpetrator outside of myself is actually what I'm doing to myself.
Yes.
It's what I'm doing to myself. And so with that, for me, and I want to hear from you, when I think about these teachers or these people who I've respected and followed, and when I watch them fall, you know, from the throne, either they put themselves on, I put them on, both probably all at the same time, versus sitting in the victim mode, how dare you? How could you do that to so-and-so? How could you do that to me? I think the greatest gift is saying, how could I do that to myself? Where did I stop listening to myself? Mm-hmm. Right? And so maybe share with that. I don't really know how to ask it in a very eloquent way. So I can't even say the word right now, eloquent way. So I'll just say it as it is. When did you decide to leave John's community?
When I felt that elephant in the room, already the year before that was, I felt myself very quite struggling going there. And then after that, I walked away and I said, no, it just doesn't feel right to me. And it was heartbreaking because so many of my really good friends were part of it.
Of course.
You know, so, and I wanted to belong to the community, but I remember that's exactly the same thing that I did with Osho. Mm-hmm. At one point, I wanted to belong to the community. It did not align with Osho anymore, even though there was so much bliss involved, but there was something that was
right? And Geha, I think that is, and I absolutely hate this whole saying, but the saying of throwing the baby out with the bathwater is, just because some aspect of that didn't work for you doesn't mean that we need to get rid of all of it.
I am so with you on that. I will be forever grateful for both Osho and John for what it is that I've learned, for the places that I had to look within myself. Mm-hmm. And like I said before, maybe working at McDonald's would have given me the same kind of insights. I have no idea, because I just chose the path of these spiritual teachers. And you know, I have one of my best friends, she says, I'm so done with all that guru shit. And I'm going, I'm not. Because all those gurus, they have helped me see my own inner guru.
Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, before I actually moved to Edmonton, I had one last ayahuasca ceremony on Maui. And you know, we had a few ceremonies there at that time, and it was a very sacred place because we grew our own, we made our own medicine, you know, it was our vine from the lands that a few of us were growing the vine and the chacruna and all these kinds of things. But my last vision was so vivid of me diving into my subconscious, which was absolutely beautiful. It was this shimmering height space. And there was first Osho sitting in this cave and smiling at me with a big smile. And then I would fall and tumble into the next cave. And there was John, and John was not a smiley guy. John, very serious, very, you know, and I knew that I had more journey with him. But then I kept tumbling again. And then I was confronted with myself. And
the ultimate guru.
The ultimate guru, you know, and it's not the easiest guru either, because, you know, you, as you know,
I do.
Sometimes you go and look, wow, yeah, who am I really in all of this? You know, there's so many questions that come up with all of that. Yeah. And like you said, the David Hawkins,
like power versus force, yeah, calibration.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, this calibration, right? That is so profound and so important. But what is also so beautiful is that within all of this, I think there's more and more and more. And we don't all have to be like these big gurus, but we are just these sparks of light that come and that help inspire everybody. And with this understanding and this realization that we are this electromagnetic beings that have, through our choices and through our willpower, a tiny little influence on the whole, that on itself is inspiration enough for me to go, every day I want to know what it is that I'm putting out into the world. And I want to be so clear and so helpful and positive and full of light. You know, I don't want to necessarily just go, oh, I don't have any darkness. No, I know I do. But I want to consciously create a new earth out of this compost, you know, like the lotus growing out of the mud. The best vegetables grow from really rich compost. And in these last few years, over the last centuries, but particularly these last few years, we've seen enough shit that, excuse my language, that that the compost could be unbelievably rich and fertile.
Oh, I so appreciate that you use that metaphor, because I actually think that that's the truth. It's not just a story. From all of the shittiest shit comes the most beautiful and incredible things, but we also have to go into the compost pile to find the beautiful things too, which is what you shared so brilliantly during this whole entire thing. Thank you. Like the grace that you speak with, where I know that there's probably still a lot of people who are very upset, who spend time with you in Osho's community, who will never ever be able to forgive him or to forgive themselves for being there. There's a lot of people who've joined and fallen off on John's path. And there's a lot right now who probably feel very confused and very blindsided and ripped off from that. There will continue to be these great big, I call them veil drops, where it's almost like the Wizard of Oz. You know, we kind of get to see the little man behind, and that little man behind for me just kind of feels like it is the shadow. It's the dark part. And you're right. We all have it, Geha. Just sometimes it feels a little more shocking when it's somebody who we have cast so much light, right? We're looking at their whole image in Technicolor, and we kind of forget, or we don't want to acknowledge, that there is still a shadow behind that. And I think on this planet right now, that's what this whole shifting into this next age is it's anything that was able to somehow survive behind the scenes, pulling strings for so long, it just can't anymore. So I tell people, like, buckle up, because there's way more that we are going to see, but buckle up with some compassion and to prepare yourself. Can I be a part of the team that's saying, okay, yeah, like I can see the hurt, I can see the pain, I can see the reflection of myself. I can be a part of helping to wash some of the energy around that so that we can get back to like the compost growing something new and beautiful. Or do I want to be on the team that has like the pitchforks and, you know, the torches, and do I want to burn this person down? And as a result, just continue to build and allow to fester even more rage and darkness within myself, right? Because it's at the end of the day, you know, Osho didn't die wondering, I wonder what Geha thinks of me, you know, and John's probably not sitting around right now like, geez, I'm sorry that I disappointed Geha. No. And so you have to do what feels best for you in your body. And for me, keeping that light is taking those little nuggets of gold that I've learned from those experiences, and with absolute gratitude, planting those into the soil.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for being this person on the planet. I feel like even just crying, I'm just so grateful for you right now. Oh,
thank you, Mandy. What a lovely conversation.
It was so lovely. And how can people find you? How can they receive your love?
Well, I'm an acupuncturist at Wellness on White, and we are a wonderful team. So wellnessonwhite.com is our website, and there's a few acupuncturists, and we are a whole wellness center. So, and everything from Jungian astrology, which by the way is absolutely phenomenal, to acupuncture, to massage, so all different kinds of services, to facial services, everything super holistic, organic, blah blah blah, you name it, finest of the finest, you will find us there. You will find me on Instagram under Dr. Geha, and I teach a free Qigong and yoga class every Saturday morning at 10 a.m. Please, the Mala class, please feel free to join me. I also have an interesting workshop coming up on March 5th called The Awakening. And what's lovely about The Awakening is it coincides with the beginning of spring of Chinese medicine. So, and in Chinese medicine, the spring is associated with the dragon, because the dragon in the winter hibernates and protects the treasure, literally our treasure. And then in the spring comes out and checks out what is my land and what do I rule over, right? So it is for us an invitation to again check, what are my treasures? Mm-hmm. How do I plant the seeds for the next? What are the seeds that I'm watering? Those kinds of things. And of course, the dragon and a spring energy, liver energy, is all associated with sexuality, very much what we were talking about. So bringing sexuality and bringing consciousness to that. And then I also have another workshop actually coming up around a yoni egg and the different practices associated with that. So, and those are the two places basically where you can find me. I'm also on LinkedIn. I'm on everything, but I don't really.
I will put some links into the show notes. I will put the link for your Instagram. I'll put for the website, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn. I'll find you wherever you are. And
thank you,
I will
so
make
much.
Sure you're so welcome, that everybody has the links, because you have such an incredible well of knowledge to share with everybody. And, it might be time maybe for me to do a little bit of learning on some of those things you're talking about there too.
I'd love that, Mandy. Yes.
It's time. Yes. It's time. So thank you. Thank you, Geha. Thank you everybody for listening, for watching this dialogue. And I trust that if you listened all the way through to this point right now, that there was definitely some huge takeaways from you on that as well. So please do not forget to send us some messages. If you have any feedback on this, or if there's any questions that you might have, please by all means send some messages. Also, make sure that you follow this podcast, you like, and you subscribe. And I always say, share it with somebody, maybe everybody, maybe you blast it through your social media. But specifically, when I listen to podcasts, I'm like, oh my God, this is exactly what my sister needs to hear. This is what I want my daughter to hear, or my husband to hear. Don't pause, send this airway, because you never know who you are going to be impacting. So thank you. And thank you again. We'll talk soon, Geha. Bye now.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Waking Up Human podcast. If you're looking for additional resources, anything from education on mindfulness, meditation, and just simply how to stress less, to engaging in a community, one where you can show up and be seen and heard and even get the insights from other people. As we all know, that feeling like we belong and that we are connected is our one and only primary human need, then I have the place for you. You can join my membership community known as The Practice. And to find out more about this beautiful, supportive community that is filled with tools, resources, and all of the support that you need to lead a mentally strong and healthy life, then go to visit www.mandytrap.com and learn all about The Practice there. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and to send this podcast to somebody else who you think could benefit from it. Take care.